Good afternoon. We'd like to start the session, which is session number 234. That's entitled Shattered, Six Steps from Betrayal to Recovery. And I'd like to remind you at this point in time to turn off your cell phones or pagers or anything. And if you think, you know, go ahead and take a minute right now and pull it out and see if it's on silent, see if it's on vibrate, because then it's not only is it kind of a little embarrassing when it goes off, but also if you're listening to the tape later and it's really annoying to hear the person who's talking's voice covered up with somebody's cell phone going off ringing. So that's always a good polite thing to do. My name is Perry Porter, and I'll be the moderator for this panel. And we have the three people who decided that the best way to get the ball rolling is come up and take 5 minutes and kind of introduce themselves and where they're at in their perspective. And then we'll begin with some questions. I'll come up with the first one, and then we'll continue on with questions after that.
I feel so bad that I put a mint in my mouth. It's a really good mint, but I'm not sure what to do with it right now. I don't think, Perry, you wouldn't hold it for me, would you? No, I'm just kidding. We're excited to be here today. We've had... Oh, do you mind if I do this? My mom's not here. Thank you. Oh, my gosh. That was not a good idea. We're excited to be here today to discuss a very interesting subject that always brings up a lot of dialogue. So we invite you to participate in the questions, any questions you might have, any comments. My particular background is that I was a co-author of the book Shattered. The foreword to this book was written by Thelma Suarez, Lori Hacking's mother. My co-author Faye and I had both experienced horrific betrayal. And we got together, we had both been writers and got together and thought we'd bumped into a lot of people who had not been able to really survive betrayal and found themselves and their lives done in, which is understandable. And then we bumped into people who were able to put this in somewhat some perspective and then move on with their lives. So we decided to put together a book that was a collaboration of stories of people who have survived betrayal and some of the things that helped them get through this time. We started the book before the murder of Lori, and at the time that she was murdered, we both felt for Thelma, because she had experienced a couple of losses. One was Lori, the other one was Mark, and all of the expectations that she had as a mother-in-law for him. And so we wrote her and said, we have a book that can't bring Lori back, but it can maybe help you understand the nature of what made Mark and do the things he did, and maybe put that in perspective for you and help you out. So she read the manuscript and was supportive of it and wrote the foreword for that, and we were grateful for that, to be able to help get this word out to people who would like to put this horrific ordeal in perspective. In my own life, I was a convert to the LDS Church at age 16. I grew up in L.A., one of nine kids, and joined the church and was very idealistic and couldn't wait to move to heaven. So I packed my bags and moved to Provo, and I was very idealistic, which was a good thing for me at the time. I don't resent that. I that's who I was. And so moved there, met a man who was a very good man, and we were very compatible, and everything seemed to be going real well. And we got married, and were married 25 years, and I had seven kids, and then I found out he had led a double life. And it wasn't all a mystery. There were signs that things had been going on, but one thing he was very good at is he read the scriptures every day, and in my mind, you know, you do all these great, wonderful things, then you read the scriptures every day, and then you get, you know, translated. The fact that he read his scriptures every day was very naive of me, but I believed that, you know, that was a great indicator that he was who he was. And even though at times I found pornography, I figured it was just, you know, something that you just kind of do every once in a while and get back on track. And I didn't want to distract our work of getting to the celestial kingdom by something as minor as pornography. I say that facetiously. That was a difficulty in our marriage, but I didn't figure it was the tip of the iceberg. I thought that this was a minor subplot to our marriage. So, at the time that I discovered that he had been going, you know, to strip joints, women, second home, there was just a lot I didn't know about. And so we're going to talk about the steps that are typical of dealing with something like this, the steps of awareness. Obviously, I was kept in a lot of denial. A lot through his manipulation, and then my idealism was perfect breeding ground for denial. Acceptance as another step. First is awareness. Second is acceptance. Third is action. Fourth is authorization. Fifth is accountability. And sixth is advancement. And these are the steps that are talked about in the book, and they're supported by stories of people who have dealt with this and therapists. And I'm happy to have Marcy Moore, who has come today to also be on the panel. She has been through some ordeals herself that have to do with betrayal, and then Duran, who's a therapist and has a lot of insight into all of these steps. She's quoted in the book and was very helpful to bringing more awareness to the issue of betrayal. So we're glad to be here, and like I said, feel free to ask any questions. So I'll turn the time over to Marcy.
Can you stop right there?
Sure.
Sorry to break the protocol that we already established, but I tend to forget things. If I don't ask the question immediately when it's happening, I'll skip on to something else. My mind gets carried away. So as you were reading this, it reminded me, as I was reading the foreword to the book, and I had a question, and maybe we'll go right back on to the next person, but I'll ask a question in the meantime. The foreword by Lori Hacking's mother, she mentions that betrayal, that temporary clouds the mind and destroys the heart. And as soon as I read that, having been involved in I'm divorced in a breakup situation that was very traumatic for myself, I thought, temporary. Wow, that seemed like a contradiction. And then even later down at the very bottom of the same page, she talks about abuse being tragic and devastating effects, silently destroying and being very destructive. And my thought and question was, she seems to be within like paragraphs of each other contradicting herself. And I was wondering, you know her really well, and kind of help me through that, because I was disturbed by the say that this thing's temporary clouds the mind. I mean, wow, it lasts for a long time.
Sure. Okay. Appreciate that. I think, first of all, at the time that Thelma wrote this, it was so new, you know, that I think her words were possibly not as well thought out. No discredit to her, she was great, but I think now she might say that that's more permanent than she was thinking at the time. Sometimes when we go through things, we pretty much hope they're going to be temporary. Somebody explained to me, and I've used this analogy to my kids and everything, and I don't mean this to be a depressing thought, it's an empowering thought, that sometimes when you go through something like horrific betrayal, it can feel a lot like its own handicap, its own emotional handicap. Or like having an arm severed in an accident. You can learn to live without the arm. Some days you'll miss it. Some days you'll wish that you had it back, but you can put it in perspective and also have, you know, hopefully a lot of time where you can be productive and maintain your own life. So that would be the comment I would have about Thelma. I think first that it was recent, you know, so recent, I just even felt bad for her, but she really did want to do that, and so she did. But I think she might even admit that it's, yeah, you're right. There's I always say to the kids, we're going to walk with pain today. Yeah, don't fight it. It becomes your little companion. So, does that answer your question? Okay, great. Good afternoon. Is this the way? Is it? Okay. I have a really soft voice, so I will try and remember to speak up. My name is Marcy Maurer, and I'm a survivor of domestic violence. I'm a single mother of four, and I own a few retail stores. Okay. Is that better or worse?
You can hear me when I was... Did it come through the speakers?
It wasn't necessarily coming through the speakers.
Apparently it's not been working.
Okay. All right. Well, then I... Then I'll just ignore it and just try and speak up. Okay. Along with being a contributing writer for many articles on domestic violence, I'm also a speaker on the Victim Empathy Panel for the state of Utah. And my early childhood consisted of physical, emotional, and verbal abuse. And on my 16th birthday, I was gang raped in exchange for drug money. I was threatened if I ever told anyone that they would kill me, so I suppressed the memory for another 16 years. My low self-esteem and chronic depression made me a victim for many, many abusive relationships in professional and personal life. As an adult, I have survived every abuse known to man: emotional, physical, verbal, mental, sexual, financial, and spiritual. I've been beaten, raped, choked, tortured, stalked, betrayed, lied to, humiliated, and received threats on my life. And none of this was from a stranger or even an acquaintance. Every cruel and inhumane way that I've been treated has come from a person that I loved and that professed to love me in return. And out of all of the abuse that I have suffered, what still hurts me today is the way that I was treated. It's the names I was called, the lies I was told, and the humiliation of being betrayed. And it's the wounds that you can't see that can kill you. I've done a lot of hard things in my life. I had a baby with cancer. I almost lost my teenager to diabetes. I went back to college as an adult. I bought a business. I started a new business. And I went on welfare. But getting over the effects of domestic violence in my life has been the hardest work that I have ever had to do. And it almost killed me. And I did not deserve to die. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcy, for sharing that. And I realize that it's very difficult to turn around and speak to others and be vulnerable. And it was very moving to hear that. And I think that most of us can picture a lot of the abuse that you spoke about. And the question that, as I was listening to you speak, you mentioned spiritual abuse. And I wanted you to just flesh out just for a second. I think everybody else has their predetermined definitions of all the other abuse and can either seen that or known that. But I wanted to know what you thought spiritual abuse was and define that and tell us just a little bit, just for a minute, what that was about.
Sure. The spiritual abuse...
Put the mic, yeah. Otherwise, it won't be on the tape.
Okay. For me, the spiritual abuse came in forms of comments from that ranged like, oh, there she goes, she's having one of her feelings again. Very sarcastic remarks. And let's see, another thing would be after praying about something specifically and feeling like I received an answer, being told that I was not worthy to receive inspiration, that it was Satan that was talking to me, and that there's absolutely no possible way that I could be receiving any kind of revelation or inspiration because of the broken, bad person that I was. So to me, negating any spiritual feelings, any personal revelation, inspiration, anything like that, negating in being told that the devil has you in his clutches, to me, is spiritual abuse.
Hi, I'm Duran Mitchell. I have allergy voice today, so I hope that you can hear me. I'm a clinical social worker, have been in the field for well over 30 years, and I'm a friend of Betty Ann's. And when she told me she was doing her book, I was happy and pleased to discuss some aspects of it with her. I think that she and Faye put together a wonderful book that speaks very directly, very easily, explains very complicated issues that obviously touch the heart and touch the soul in a way that can be well understood and not necessarily in psychological terms that are hard to understand. I was really struck by Marcy's opening lines, and I thought, as a therapist, personally, it's important, and I think, from my own point of view, to be very respectful. It's an act of faith for someone, no matter what circumstance brings them to professional counseling or to seek professional help, especially perhaps if ecclesiastical leaders have not been very forthcoming or able to counsel. And I certainly don't take it lightly, and I think this is a place where Betty Ann and Faye's book helps. It kind of fills that void, I believe, between professional help, perhaps, and what someone is dealing with individually. So I'm happy to be here on the panel and hope that you do ask the hard questions. As Perry put it, the softball questions or the hardball questions. We're willing to take them all. Thank you.
As a kind of a follow-up question to have you answer first, and then the other two can, and we'll just kind of freewheel it if you have something that you want to add to it or not. I did have a little bit of difficulty purchasing the book in time to read the whole thing, and I went through the first couple of chapters and the last couple of chapters, and I had to feign ignorance that I haven't read the whole thing, so I don't know if there's, when asking this question, on page two, it's talked about trust and instinct, and you mentioned that sometimes he was physically abusive to me, et cetera, et cetera. And as I was going through that, I thought what was missing from the book for me were examples. I mean, you use the words, but you don't describe and make it real by talking specifically about things that happen. I know that's a double-edged sword. Sometimes you turn around at one point, you create more violence by depicting that or you know, talking about pornography all the time gets people interested in pornography and gets them involved in that. Does the book ever have graphic depictions of where people, because sometimes when I hear people's stories and they tell in detail the blows and the things that happened to them and where they were at and the scars they were looking at days later makes it so real that it makes me so more determined to protect people from violence. Yesterday there was a film, I don't know if many of you saw it, but Richard Dutcher's film was very, very graphic, very, very violent. And for some people that turned them off, to me it gave more humanity to be more caring and more loving, because those people who are victims of this violence and this abuse, I had increased empathy for them. Would someone like to, any of you like to turn around and, or do you get graphic in the book at all? In, go ahead.
Okay.
No,
I can. Am I standing? Yep. Okay.
Go ahead and mic.
All right.
As the book goes through, it does talk about, I'm just trying to think of her name, and it's just left me right now, but one woman in particular had suffered a lot of physical violence and was stalked, and it walks through her story and how she lost her job because he just, you know, badgered her at work and badgered her, the management, and how she had to leave and flee and take her kids. And there are some stories of that nature. There's also stories from men, because this isn't, sometimes we think this only happens to women, and it happens to everybody. And it happens, betrayal happens in many forms. It can be in the form of a job that you expected, or being betrayed by an employer, and you know, just betrayal happens in many forms, in many degrees. And so the book does include stories about that are graphic. It includes a list of signs to look for that was given to us by the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. The signs, I was it's a list of emotional and physical abusive signs. So it does get into detail. To be honest with you, to have put in all the stories that we collected and go into depth about all of them, this book could be 80 million pages long, which is sad, but there's just so many stories out there. I remember one time speaking at a certain organization downtown. It was a group of wonderful women that were all, you know, 70s and 80s, and they asked us to come, 90s, yes, and one lady came up to me afterwards and said, she was married for 50 years. She was a therapist, and her husband had passed away, and she had met a man, and she started crying. She said, I'm in my 80s. And I just was betrayed for the first time. And so it covers, sadly enough, every age group, everything, everybody. And so there's a lot of stories out there. I believe the story is only tip of the iceberg, this book, that there's other books out there that are just awesome, too. This is one of them also. And so, you know, we're hoping to get the word out that there just is, you know, the opportunity to get past this and keep some sort of perspective and empowerment over your own life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You went to the six steps pretty quickly.
Okay, I know.
What are the six steps? And I'd be interested, because I've worked a lot of this. What is your definition of betrayal?
Of betrayal would be, we actually have it in the book, and I'm sorry that I'm, let's see. It would be, well, it's any time, it's a general, it's not a specific, it's a pretty general term of just any time there's a loss of expectation based on manipulation and lies. Does that make sense? When you buy into something that you're not getting back in return, and I'm sure that could be debated, but for the sake of the book, it was talking in terms of relationships, of job loss, of all kinds of relationships, and so the term was pretty general, but it was in terms of any time you are not getting back your investment based on a set of, you know, lies and mistruths and manipulation that leads you down a road that you don't think you were going down that road. You thought you were going down this road. So that would be the definition of betrayal.
Go through the steps again for a moment.
Okay. I'm going to borrow the book. It sounds okay. Just to make sure I've got them right. The first is awareness. And we were going to talk in depth about a little bit about each of these steps. Duran had some interesting things. We learned a lot along the way. We are no experts. We're not healed fully in anything. Like you mentioned, temporary, you know, there's always going to be growth in this area and learning. But the first step we discussed was awareness. The second one was acceptance. The third, action. The fourth, authorization. Duran pointed this out, and we sat down. She says, this is the most difficult one in some respects, because a lot of times we've lived so long in a relationship or in a situation where we haven't naturally been given a certain amount of authority, that to all of a sudden give ourselves authority to do what needs to be done can be pretty difficult. Accountability is the fifth one, and sixth is advancement, advancing your life forward.
I'm going to draw momentarily from my own personal experience. I've been single for 7 years now, and in that process, I want to learn and grow from everyone else's experience. Sometimes I'll see singles, and they'll get married, and 3 months later, this is their second or third marriage, and I see them back out of the single scene again, and the first thing I do is I go up to them, I talk to them, and I go, tell me what happened. What did you learn? I'm not looking for you to point fingers. I'm not looking for you to disclose things that are too personal for you, but what did you learn in that process? And if I can get them to open up and talk about what happened in that process, a lot of them I found have been abused, and they go back again to abusive relationship again. And I go, didn't you see any of the signs or red flags where you're dating? And a certain percent of them will say, yeah, I saw this red flag, but I thought it wasn't going to matter, it wasn't going to happen this time. And other people say, I was totally deceived. 6 months into the marriage, suddenly he became the same abusive parent, the person or spouse that I'd been married to before, and it was suddenly, it kept happening again. Would any of you like to turn around and comment on some of the red flags that you see about abuse, where they come up, and then an experience that you've had with people who somehow just, they're so much in love that they turn the blinders off, and even though the red flags are popping up all around them, they still get back into that same kind of relationship that they were before. They just switch partners.
Okay. I'm very grateful that Perry addressed that, because this is one of my passions, is red flags. Because the cycle of abuse is so difficult to break. And there are red flags. If someone has told you that they have been totally deceived and it came out of the blue, then what they're basically saying is, I chose to ignore the red flags, because it has been my personal experience that there are always red flags. It is our choice. This is where it depends on your state of awareness, which is one of the steps. It's a very, very important step, because you cannot do anything about becoming accountable unless you are aware that you're being abused. There has to be that awareness first. There are red flags. There are three main ones that I'd like to talk about. There's physical, mental, and spiritual. A physical red flag would be if you're talking to someone and you have a gut punch. You've got a pit in your stomach. You are sweating. Your jaw is clenching. You go to pick up the phone. There's a text message from someone that you've been seeing or from a member of your family, and just seeing their cell phone number on your phone gives you a physical gut reaction. That is a physical red flag. And so what do you do? Do you ignore it? What do you do? So the mental red flag would be if you find yourself rationalizing in your mind, if you find yourself making up excuses for this person, if you find yourself lying to people that you trust, hiding facts, if you are confused, if you feel like you're in a brain fog when you're talking to this person, if you're unclear, if the kinds of things that you are thinking or that you are feeling, are they healthy thoughts or are they unhealthy thoughts? Do you find yourself feeling like you've been swept away? Most people would think being swept away and especially in a romantic relationship is something that you want. I'm here to tell you, if you are feeling like you're swept away, that means that your feet are not grounded. Being swept away is a romantic notion, and it's a huge red flag. So so a spiritual red flag would be, it would be that knowing. It would be the sensing. It would be what some people call your intuition. If you're of a Judeo-Christian faith, then it would be called the light of Christ or the Holy Ghost. It is that knowing that something doesn't quite feel right. It's that sense that you have about you that something isn't quite right here. And you can't quite put your finger on it, and you're not sure. But I think most of you in this room know what I'm talking about. It's the sense that you feel like something isn't quite right. Now, why do we ignore red flags? There's quite a few reasons why. A big one could be society's rules. It could be gender related. Women are taught to be polite, to not judge, to be fair, to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. And as children, we might be taught to play with someone who no one else would play with. And as young women, we might be taught to go on a date with someone who no one else will date. We are not taught that we should ask the question, why won't anybody play with that child? Why won't anybody date this guy? Instead, we are taught the exact opposite. Family traditions and our training is a big reason why we ignore our red flags. Home is where we learn to excuse abusive behavior. I'll repeat that again. It is in our home, when we're growing up, that we learn to excuse abusive behavior. If someone yells, oh, they only yell when they're drunk. Or if they're a hard worker, if you're a hard worker, then you're a good guy. And, he's Irish. Irish always have temper. Oh, he's German. You Germans are big drinkers. It's this type of thing that we're taught in our home. I call it the Eddie Haskell syndrome. Do you remember Leave It to Beaver, some of you? Who was Eddie Haskell? He was the charming friend who always came to the door. Good morning, Mrs. Cleaver, always with a smile. And then he was out doing this mischievous pranks and messing around. It's the Eddie Haskell syndrome. It's good manners do not equate to a good character. And if you're taught that someone has good manners in your home, that equates that they're a good person, then that could be a red flag. Ted Bundy was incredibly charming. A profession. We might be taught in our home that all doctors can be trusted, or something like that, or anybody that happens to have a spiritual collar on, that is a man of the cloth. They can be trusted. And so it depends on what we're taught in our home. And then the last one is our own mental health and our history of abuse. And why I ignored my red flags was I found mostly, I could pick out every single one of these that I was indoctrinated by my family traditions and training, that society played a part in it. But most of it had to do with my past history of abuse, was I was still numb from all the abuse. I had not become aware of it yet. Maybe I was aware partially, but wasn't fully awake, kind of in that groggy half sleep. Sometimes I got it, sometimes I didn't. And I was still numb from all the abuse and hadn't healed. That makes a person especially susceptible to abuse. And I did not see the flags. When you're numb, you don't see anything. And I was also conditioned to be treated poorly. And I didn't know any different, and I didn't have the education that I needed to be able to notice the red flags. And once I noticed the red flags, then it was still difficult, and it's still a process. So that's. Does anyone have any questions about red flags? Yes, thank you.
I actually run a survivors group. The hardest ones for me are those people that remain attracted to emotionally and sexually. Mm-hmm. Because they were programmed that way. They were, they had family. Some of it's reenactment, but they're actually attracted to repeating and saying, mm-hmm. You know, what would life be? You know, in domestic cases, that like makeup sex or mm-hmm. saying, you know, it's almost a step further, but mm-hmm. I don't want to give.
Mm-hmm. If we could get you in the future to come up to the mic and ask the question. Otherwise,
your question's
good. Could you rephrase what he said so mm-hmm. people can hear it? Because there will be a lot of people that will want to mm-hmm. listen to the program later. So just try to rephrase.
Okay. And correct me if I'm wrong. What I'm understanding you saying is that as the leader of a survivor abuse, you find that people are stuck in the cycle.
Some. It's not just stuck, it's
repeating the same behaviors. They're attracted to it.
They're attracted in many instances with numerous rape victims. They're attracted sexually. Mm-hmm. You know, unless there's blood, it doesn't stimulate.
Mm-hmm. And this is my personal opinion, and the rest of the panel can probably weigh on this, because this is a very good question. Why are they attracted to, why do I seem to walk into a room and every perpetrator and predator in the room seems to be gravitated towards me? And, predators seem to have an uncanny knack for doing that, and there's been a lot of studies on, especially on emotional predators, that they seem to be able to do just that. And to me, it starts with one of the steps. It's being accountable. Someone who keeps repeating the same behaviors, even though they have the awareness, in my estimation, has not reached full accountability. Now, I'm not talking about victim bashing here, because I would never, ever bash a victim. But once you become old enough, I'm not talking about children, but once as an adult, when you see yourself repeating the same behaviors over and over again, who are you blaming? Are you blaming the perpetrator? They're so easy to blame. It's so easy to blame. Yes, yes, he is a dangerous criminal. Yes, he is. Yes, and he has hurt me, and he has abused me. But to me, you need to be accountable. That's what helped me to break the cycle, was I said, okay, I am not a brainless idiot. I am intelligent, and I work hard. I also am of the Latter-day Saint faith. I work hard to have the Spirit with me so I can tell deceptions, yet I get fooled. I work hard. So what is it that I am missing? And I take accountability and say, you know what, I am in this dance together with this person. And for me, if it's like, you know what, if an abuser has no one to abuse, if you don't let yourself be abused, true, they will go find someone else. And that's really sad. But I don't know, does that answer your question? To me, it's the accountability. It's placing the blame on the person and not taking responsibility as an adult, not as a child, but as an adult.
That's very, very difficult.
It's incredibly difficult. It is, and I'm not saying it's easy. It is incredibly difficult. You are right. Is anyone else?
I want to make some comments in your comments, if that's okay. You can stand or sit down. Dr. Drew Pinsky, which I think some of you might be familiar with, he says that people who have been abused physically or sexually as a child, until they get sufficient amount of therapy to overcome that, they are drawn over and over and over to repeat, to put themselves in that same place, to repeat the same chaos in their life. They invite that chaos into their life. And I think it's really true. And I think part of what you're saying is being accountable is you get to that level of therapy where you're healed and you do not ask for that anymore. And for some people, maybe their wound is so bad that they can never get to the point of being healed, and they'll draw in that negative experience over and over. And to repeat what you said, and I thought was really, really good, and it's stated in a different way. I've heard it stated as the cringe factor. If you're in a social situation, you're dating or you're getting to know somebody or whatever, and maybe they make an off-colored racial slur. They make a slur about gender, or they do something as simple, you're sitting out at dinner, and instead of using their napkin sits on the table the entire time, and they wipe their mouth with their hand, and it makes you cringe. That's described as you have a visceral or a body reaction that your core values are different than this other person's core values, and your body tells you, you are not really compatible with this person, but you're attracted to them, so ignore it. So if you cringe maybe once in a 3 or 4 hour episode with somebody, blow it off. If you've cringed 5, 6 times in a 2 hour date, those are red flags. Your body is telling you, you are not compatible with this person, stay away. And I'm just kind of, my own perspective, and I've heard it a different way, just some of the same words to repeat the same thing that you're saying. Another thing I wanted to start, another kind of thread on this topic of abuse, and maybe involve the other panel members. To me, my experience has been someone who has been physically, or particularly physically abused, is that they have an when they'll tell their story about being abused, there is a certain confidence and there is a certain attitude that they have that this will never happen again. Don't you even look at me. If you're an abusive person, march out right on by, because I am not going to allow this to ever happen again in my life. And other people I've talked to, and they were just fresh out of a divorce, and the person was abusive, and I would talk to them about it, and I just had this gut feeling that they're going to go back, and they're going to go back to the same thing, because they have not got to that point where they have set their foot in the sand and they're going, I'm not going to let anyone cross this line ever again in my life.
Is this smoke and mirrors for me? Am I? Is that right?
Can you feel that from people?
Yes,
you know?
Yeah, sure. I think that is one of the hardest things to deal with, actually, is we all have to live in denial. Denial is not bad. That's how we get up and we go outside, even though the bombs could be dropped on us. We all have to use a little denial. It's when it becomes pathological and starts working against us, and it's not always easy to know that. So as part of the process, which Marcy described, the whole book is about the process of healing. You'll be at different places, and acceptance is number two. Awareness was number one. Acceptance is number two. And if we're in, I don't always speak this way, but if I'm in a group of people who are based at least in Latter-day Saint knowledge, if you believe in free agency, other people get to have the choices and make the choices they will over their own lives. We're always kind of butting up against one another's free agency. No matter where you are in this process, the reality is we could all be betrayed again. Now, when you start the process, you kind of have to draw those lines to begin it, but at the end of the process, it must incorporate this kind of larger radical acceptance about our lives, and that we still go on, and that we will still be able, during having found the strength through the process, to deal with that again. Now, that doesn't mean I'm saying that these people in, it's Glenn, right? In Glenn's group should run out and act on the attraction and invite those people back in. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying the reality out there is this can happen to us again. If we let people close to us, whether they're predators or really not good people, at some point we make mistakes and they can hurt us and they can betray us. So it's learning on this kind of larger level, making peace with it some way and being able to move on in our lives. And I thought, because I know you're a therapist, Glenn, but I think my own evolution in working in terms of therapy is I would have hit that heavy cognitively, and I've learned it's behaviorally now. Really. It's kind of like, you know, attraction is attraction, okay? You just are attracted to certain things, but you don't have to act on the attraction. That's the behavioral piece, and that's the part, like in therapy, that I would try to make some inroads. Fine, be attracted, be aware. Oh my gosh, here's this guy, and you know, or here's this woman, and here I'm going down that road. And I'd say, well, okay, there's the attraction, but let's choose another road. Let's go another way, and then that's where that piece may come in, so.
I've always said that this life would be a piece of cake if we didn't have to come here with emotion. A lot of the things that I went through in my life, logically on paper, I would have picked them up right away. But I was emotionally involved in this relationship that, you know, and also I believe that in my situation, I always said if they made a movie about my story, they'd be upset at my husband, my ex-husband first, and then they'd be really mad at me because it was like, you know, getting hit on the head and hit on the head. In my case, I remember going through this. He was in the bishopric and on the high council, a very successful man, great with kids. We got called us the EFY of the ward. The bishop had said he had won over the confidence of everybody in the ward. I only say that because I think, like what Duran said, sometimes this can actually happen. I've always thought of myself as somebody who doesn't let a lot get past me. I ask all the questions every wife asks. In the end, he really was good at what he did. There's a book called Trauma Bonding by Dr. Patrick Carnes, and he walks through the steps of why we're attracted to this type of individual, how they pull us in and tell a story, and we believe that story. And then if something comes along that contradicts that story, and we get the cringe. But they're good enough to reinvite us back and explain that story. Oh! So the cringe goes away. And then, you know, you go along, believe it. In my case, I found the pornography 4 months after we were married in the temple in 1975. And, you know, he said he was just curious, and I'm open-minded. I was open-minded being a convert. I thought, well, that doesn't sound quite out of the ordinary to me. I'll just, you know, you don't want to police your own relationship in some respects. So I was trying to be the understanding wife and got reinvested. So, you know, then within the same year, found it again, and I was like, you know, I thought this was kind of a one-time deal. It's kind of odd, and, you know, it doesn't fit with who you are. But the invitation was again presented to, you know, great guy. Great guy. I learned a lot from him. I'm not going to sit and trash him because he had a lot going for him, but he had some problems in some areas that just didn't work for the relationship. But then in his book, Dr. Karn's book, he talks about how something will come along that is cold water in your face that you can't ignore, and he can't reinvest. And that, I felt like I related more to that situation in my own relationship. Things, I don't know if things got piled up because I don't fully know the whole story. I knew enough to get out of the relationship at that point. But there was a lot of kindness. You know, he was a great husband, model. You know, I told him in the end, you ought to go to Hollywood and, you know, start an acting career because I'll give you credit for one thing. You're good, you know. And so in my situation, that was, there were red flags. And I look back and kick myself now. That's why I said if somebody watched the movie, they'd say, come on, this one's got to be. But on the other hand, there was also a reinvestment. So while you're going along in this thing, you know, I went through a lot of therapy, and the therapist said it was actually just a matter of time before this thing would run out because of the combination of his actions and my denial. But anyway, so I would just toss that out, that while there's a lot of cases where denial is the overwhelming factor, there's also the situation where there's a manipulation that can reinvite you and reinvite you, and you know, we all want to be give benefit of the doubt. Now the pendulum's kind of swung the other way, and I police just about everything that comes my way. I did, you know, meet a man, I have remarried, and within the first year of the marriage, if his shirt was moved from this place to that place, I was sure a woman was involved. So, you know, there was some PTSD involved in that, and fortunately for the both of us, we did go to counseling to try and get past all of the trauma, because we wanted to get past it. We want to live. I said my ex got me, but he didn't get all of me, and so I'm going to rebuild, because I actually like my life. I've liked my life my whole life, and nobody's going to stop me from liking it. So, you know, I got involved in counseling that would help me understand some of the things that I had gone through and was going through and actually will continue to go through, because this life is so fluid. So, anyway, that would be my comment at that.
Right there.
Yeah.
Oh. The six steps, the one that doesn't seem as self-explanatory as others is authorization. Could you just take, like, just a little blurb on what that's all about?
Sure. Authorization is, and in my relationship, my ex said to me, you know, a lot of things in our family, they're family things, so they should just be kept in the family. We don't talk about a lot of these things. They're personal and private, and so a lot of my, what I was experiencing, I didn't run by anybody. You know, I just held a hard, fast rule that, you know, what goes on in the home stays in the home. And so it, and then that builds within you, and you start losing permission to take care of business, to stand up for the things that you would normally stand up for outside of the home. I lost the ability to stand up for a lot of things because the pattern had been set down that, you know, I just lost a lot of authority, rightful authority, not unrighteous dominion or anything like that, but just the authority we all have in us to stand up for what we believe in. And so that chapter explores, you know, when it's time. I remember in my situation, when I had discovered, you know, just the loss, I went downstairs and he was watching pornography on our big screen TV. You know, then I finally started to, somebody said, you got to start digging. You know, that wasn't even digging, because who thinks of digging, you know, in your relationship? But, and I also was told a problem isn't a problem until it complicates your life. And this problem was complicating my relationship, which was my life, in some respects. So anyway, I started exploring and found a ton of stuff. And a lot of pornography, a lot of starting your own porn site, just I won't go on, but it was enough for me. And so, but all the while, I'm going to church. I'm smiling, you know, things are okay at our home. And then, when this started to unravel, he was put up went up to the LDS psych ward. He was under suicide watch because his, double life had been exposed. And I thought, you know, I'm a good Mormon. It's good to go to church today. Get that strength that you need, not realizing that I was emotionally in surgery. And I went to church, and every man who stood up, the dialogue in my head got worse and worse. And it was fortunate that I didn't stand up and start yelling in the middle of the meeting, "Who are you and what do you do Monday through Saturday?" I lost it.
I just asked, did your bishop believe you?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Did the bishop believe me? No. He did not believe me, and I totally understood that. I thought, I can understand this. I was the convert. I was the one out there, you know, with my kids TPing at night. I don't know. You know, it just seemed like I would be the one that would do something, and he was white shirt tucked in belt. Yeah. So, when this first happened, he didn't believe me, and I said, I can understand that. In time, you will. And I had another bishop who said to me, you don't realize, hey, you're on the right medication. Because you don't realize what you're telling me. I pride myself on discernment. I said, you know, I was in bed with him, and I pride myself on discernment, too. I mean, you know, I'm sleeping with a guy. It's just that he was that good. You know, he was that good.
So did they finally acknowledge?
Yeah.
15 years, and I still can't get that. Bishop or the state president? He was on the high council.
Oh, no.
But eventually, okay. George did.
Yes. Yeah, she asked the question, did my bishop eventually discover this? And in her situation, you're in a situation where it's been 10 years, and they're still not believing what happened. Oh, my gosh.
Sit there and give you a temple recommend.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And, I have to say in my own case, because I'm sandwiched between two interesting situations, the man that I did marry was a battered husband, and his ex-wife is stalking us. And she has a temple recommend. And she's got a warrant out for arrest. And, you know, so there's all this on, you know, on paper, it's not looking real good about who's who. Yeah. Ken and I were a good match, because Kent needed some self-esteem building. And I don't know, I was raised with parents that were huge on self-esteem, said explore your path and whatever it is, enjoy it to the max. And so we all, you know, 9 kids, I've got a Catholic sister, every religion, every, you know, 2 gay siblings, which, whatever. We just pursued our path because that was a path that worked for us. So I'm big on whatever that path is, explore your path. I've said to the kids, you know, I'll die a Mormon because that's what I enjoy in my life, but I'm, you know, they give you the same favor my folks gave me, explore your path. So, so that's a sidetrack on Kent, but it's been a wonderful relationship to help him experience the freedom he needed in a battered situation. In my situation with the bishop, my ex had come to me, my daughter had just left on a mission, he came to me and asked me to sign a loan on a house. He was in the mortgage business, and I said, he asked me to sign as a loan officer, and I'm doing dishes. And I said, I don't know anything about loans, anything. And I'm like, well, come on, you know. And I'm thinking in my mind, daughter on a mission, reads the scriptures, just gave a great talk in church, you know. And you know, when push came to shove, I was like, you know, it always ended up balancing in his favor. And I thought, well, certainly he wouldn't lie to me. I mean, who lies and reads the scriptures? That just doesn't mix with me. That's just terrible to say, but that was such a barometer for everything that came up. Me, scriptures, him, scriptures, me, no scriptures. Okay, I'll vote for him. So he asked me to do that. Push came to shove. I said, if I go to prison, it's on your shoulders. Ha ha. Laughed, you know, like you do, and signed him. And then when the relationship started to unravel 2 months later, I'm like, wait a minute. All of a sudden, I remembered that loan. And I, you know, he had called one night or so. I said, I want those loan papers back. What did I sign? Oh, don't worry about it. Just don't worry about it. I was like, you know, I am worried about it, and so, you know, I'm going to worry about it, and I'm going to stay worried about it. So, he was meeting with the bishop at the time, you know, backslap, handshake, visits, and I called my bishop. I said, I'm worried about this loan I signed. Can you ask him about this loan? And so the bishop, you know, talked to him and asked him, and bishop called me and said, he told me about the loan and said that it fell through, and just not to worry about it. I said, well, if it fell through, that's too easy to say to me. I mean, why hasn't he told me that it fell through? And, you know, I wasn't satisfied with that. And then during that week, I got a letter in the mail saying, I won't hold you accountable for this loan if you'll keep your mouth shut. So I called the bishop and read him the letter, and he said, wow, okay. He saw the letter, met with my ex-husband again. My ex-husband said, you know, I've been thinking I need to go to another ward. So that was the end of that. So anyway, it takes a while, and I just understand that. I don't think that, you know, you have to be patient with the process, and in the long run, it's, I do think that the life we live, the life we lead, really is what's most important. I'm not worried about who gets temple recommends and who doesn't, because that's something that's going to sort itself out in the end. But I am concerned and sink myself into the max on my own life. You know, anything else is kind of sour, you know, just sour places to go. I think that. I just think I'd rather, because if I get caught up in that, I'm chasing a covered wagon that's on a pretty wild ride. So.
Can I just
say something?
Sure. I think, and I don't know who would like to address that, because since it is Sunstone, the return to the culture, one of the complicating factors, I would suggest are, I mean, all cultures, all families have their illusions. But Mormons are raised with, you know, the movies are always happy at the end, and particularly with women, if you just marry, everything will turn out. And so I was sitting here while we were thinking about that there are betrayals that are also self-illusions. That, I mean, I can think of clients and friends that it's almost like an unconscious bargain with God. If I live all these rules, my life will work out. And then suddenly my strong belief structure didn't work out. The person died. Something, you know, and it all comes apart. It just, you know what I'm talking about. It all comes apart, so there's almost a betrayal of our illusions. If I live by this, I was promised everything would work out. I would be happy ever after. So some of the betrayal in some ways is our own sense of what life, what we were taught, both by family, church, culture, and buying off on that. So, mm-hmm. Do you want to comment on that? Was that clear?
Yeah. When I was revisiting the book today, and I talked to Betty Ann about authorization, and you had asked about authorization, this is the whole issue of authorization. You know, we develop emotionally, we develop physically, we can develop spiritually, and it is about taking our own trust and reworking those younger illusions, ideas that really weren't real. That's part of the process we have to do so that we can actually die with integrity at some day. And so when someone has betrayed us, we trusted them, and now we can't trust them any longer. But the bigger problem is that we can't trust ourselves. And so that really goes more to the crux of the dilemma. And authorization is a nice word to say it's a huge process to take back responsibility and trust and rework our world, almost redefine it in the way that Glenn mentioned. Get, you know, those illusions don't work anymore. It's kind of like, I like to think of it, if you've ever been in an earthquake, you know, you had this idea till you were in an earthquake that the ground shouldn't move. You move, the ground stays stable. But after an earthquake, you and the ground have to create a whole new relationship. And I think that's really what happens in these kinds of situations. And the bad news is, the good news is there was growth through this. So some of those things we had to rework, and unfortunately maybe it was betrayal that brought us to that, as opposed to some other exciting, real epiphany in a wonderful way. It could have happened to us in a negative way, but this is the growth, I believe, that can come out of it.
Glenn, to kind of flesh out a story that I've heard, and I don't remember, you know, having talked to so many women over the so many years, I don't remember the name of who it was, but she had a very telling story about her husband and who she was since divorced from. He had something had happened in his teenage years right before his mission or during his mission or some point in time. I'm guessing some kind of sexual indiscretion. And he made a commitment that he was going to read the scriptures or read from the Ensign or for some church periodical a half an hour every day for the rest of his life. And somehow, by doing that, that was going to make up for whatever had happened in the past. And he made this, during his mission, he made this covenant to himself. And to this day, he has kept that promise. And whether he's on vacation and doing, I don't even know, I can't remember all the stories about all the different things that would happen, but would never miss. He would not go to sleep without spending a half an hour reading either the scriptures or the Ensign. And when he'd been through more than one divorce, she was like the second wife or the second marriage. And he had complained about the first wife being unfaithful and just railed on and on about this and this and what a terrible person she was. And after they got divorced, he was unfaithful to her as well. After he got divorced, it came out and he was later excommunicated, and he had had between 40 and 50 affairs during a 20, 30 year marriage to two different people, living a very duplistic life. On one hand, going to church, never missing, reading the scriptures daily, and on the other hand, condemning his former wives for infidelity when he was the one that was the perpetrator of ruining many, many a marriage and hurting many people, and had to go to, was excommunicated, had to go to sexaholics, alias sexaholics, etc., etc. What is it? And I don't get it, because I don't find a lot of fascination in reading scripture myself. I find it kind of boring. But what is it that women think, just because a man reads something that's somewhat boring, that makes them a spiritual person and makes them so that they're trusted? I don't get that. Can someone answer that for me?
I'm going.
I have to say, I don't know that it's the scriptures per se. In my case, it was, but in another, situation, it might be just unbelievable service, performed or something that gets to be the area of focus. But I do believe in my situation, it was the compensation for behaviors that were looking to be forgiven. I see a lot of that pattern in that relationship, that if I do really great over here, instead of doing great over here and working on over here, it kind of would cancel each other out. I do have empathy for my ex in some respects. Maybe you might want to address this too, because there are a couple of questions that have been raised. One, why do men and women stay in the relationship and have the affair? That's always a question that's asked. Why would they stay in that relationship and not get a divorce and, just kind of do whatever. And, let's see, the other thing I was thinking.
Because they can.
Sure.
Because we're the wonderful wife that loves them and accepts them and forgives them and makes excuses. And
sure. And then I think this is also discussed in the book, that there's in a lot of religions, there's the standard. And in Mark Hacking, there was the standard, and he couldn't meet the standard, so he created a phony standard and rose to the standard that was actually, maybe in some respects, subliminally required. I know in my ex's situation, he came from a very, very sanitized home. And there were no problems. And so made it difficult to discuss problems, either out in the open or privately. You just don't discuss problems. And so, in that situation, I understand, how a person could go underground with that, because there is the pressure, especially on young boys, to go on a mission. And to live, while you're going along with this, and you've got everybody invested in you. It takes a lot of guts to turn around and say, well, guess what, folks? I know I'm the only boy in this ward that can go on a mission, but I can't. Yeah, and these are young boys. That takes a lot. And so, you know, there's all of that that can lead up to the behavior that we all of a sudden find ourselves, you know, associating with. So I don't know if that answers your question per se about the scriptures, but I think in my situation, the scriptures were his focus to go there. I think a lot of it was based on maybe the compensation to, you know, if I've done bad here, maybe this good will help, because maybe truly in his heart he wanted to do good, but the standard was so high and he knew. I mean, isn't the whole premise of pornography, if people knew who I really was, they wouldn't, you know, the shame factor. I always tell my kids, feel guilty, because that's a natural feeling we should have. I made a mistake, but don't feel shame. I am a mistake. And so sometimes when we go from guilt to shame, oh man, that's a hard world. I, you know, so I don't know if that played into that too.
I want to come back to guilt, but I'm ready to, we have quite a bit of time to fill, and so I'm going to throw a hardball question out there. I underlined in the book on page 128, as I was reading, and I underlined a lot of different places, but I used two different colored markers. And this one, it says, once trust has been breached, it is difficult and sometimes impossible to reconstruct. It is sometimes impossible. What are the steps? What are the steps when that... And I think the more that the deception is involved in the relationship, the deeper the betrayal is. And the more they try to be Peter Priesthood, the more they appear to be Molly Mormon, and that the reality, the public facade that all of the ward and all of the neighborhood sees, and the private reality that you experience is very, very different. How is it possible to reconstruct trust when it's been shattered?
Are you ready? Or do you want me to go or what? Oh, okay. Okay. You know, a couple of things come to my mind. One is I heard Elder Featherstone speak once, and he talked about children who were severely abused and that whole world that they come with that's so trusting and so everything, and it's shattered at a young age, how hard that is, if not impossible, to recapture. And so, you know, possibly there'll be some allowance somewhere for these children that go through that. And I thought about that a lot, because trust has been... I don't know in my own case that it ever will return. And luckily I'm with a man who does understand that, and my kids. I mean, my kids are, you know, trust is, it's like a moonbeam. I mean, it is the unseen, and it is, you know, the thing you invest in and you hope to get back. That's why you lay it out all on the table, and, you know, hoping that trust is going to be shared and treasured and built upon, and you can go back there. And there's, you know, we all have a tendency to maybe slip in a few areas of trust, like, you know, spend more money than we said we would or something like that. But when you're talking about, you know, the true investments in the relationship and also the dialogue that would follow that, you know, that says, yeah, I am who I am, and then you find out they're not, it's just that in my situation, when I went to counseling, they talked to me a lot about PTSD, because I do have areas where if something comes up, if you don't mind me, I just went to a temple marriage ceremony about 2 weeks ago, and... PTSD, I'm sorry. I thought you meant the temple. And T stands for... Okay. Okay, post-traumatic stress disorder. They talked to me a lot about that in relation to Vietnam War vets and anybody who suffered a horrific... This is discussed in the book, too. Anybody who suffered a traumatic event. I have a difficult time... Still with, I went to a temple ceremony the other day, about 3 weeks ago, and when I hear dialogue about, in that setting or in Relief Society, where this will last forever, marriage and forever, you know, it's like a bomb going off. It's a bomb. It just
it bombs me and I start doing this. In my situation, I had a brother who died of AIDS, and to go from the altars of the temple to being tested for AIDS was not something I ever imagined, and that's going to take some more years of healing. I'm not there. And so, you know, as far as trust, I was told to get, when I met Kent, I went, you know, seeing my counselor, what do I do, help me out. In my case, he said, you know, jump back in, just go with it, you know, just do it. His advice to me, and it's his advice to me, was to not sit on that, not sit on what I had been through, but, you know, go at this, and if it's a guy that was willing to work with me and get through this, that would be a very good experience. In Kent's and my situation, trust was horrible the first year we got married because he was a battered husband and I was a betrayed spouse. The mix was like a match in gasoline. And we had one situation where I listened to a message on my phone. I heard rustling of papers, the dinging of a door, and a baby crying. And I called Ken at work and said, yep, I'm a step ahead of you. I know you got a family, and I know where they are. He was like, what just happened? You know, I left the house, you were doing well, now you think I have another family. So he said, no, let's see, watch me through it, I can see how you feel this way, you know, check the time. That call actually came in when we were talking, and he was right. He was right. I had, like I said, the shirt. If it's moved from here to there, you know, who moved it? So then during that time, we were bringing home one of my daughters. There was a dialogue that went on that wasn't, you know, we had a disagreement. And I went into the house. He stayed in the car. I went in the house. The phone rang. My other daughter needed to ride home. I grabbed the keys to go pick her up. I'm now on my way outside. Kent is in the car talking to his mom. He's 6'6" and 300 pounds. And he's, mom, she's coming to get me. She's going to kill me. And he's thinking I'm going to kill him. And I'm just going to pick up my daughter for a ride. So I go in the garage, and now he thinks I've got the car, and I'm going to hit him with it. And so I leave, you know, and when I come back, he's gone. His stuff is gone. He's gone, you know. And I said, called him, Kent, where are you? Oh, you're going to kill me. You're going to kill me. I said, you know, I think we need counseling. So that's when we went into counseling. Because I've always said to Ken, at the bottom of both our hearts is really, really two good people who don't want to be hurt. But there's a lot of, you know, some weird stuff that goes on there, and counseling was awesome to help us understand why we were feeling what we were feeling. And, you know, it's a still fluid situation, but that helped.
I just want to say, you know, trust is the very first stage, according to Eric Erickson, and that's the thing we do. And so when I went through my divorce, I went right back to the first stage. I didn't trust my bishop, my own teacher. I begged them for help, and they still to this day didn't believe me. So you go back to what do you do in a baby to build trust is you do the consistent, change the diaper, give them food when they need it, and hopefully you can go back up through the stages. But when you go through what some of us have gone through, you go right back to the beginning of having to build that trust. And for me,
yeah, what they said in the book would be, in that PTSD,
the one thing that was very helpful, and you may know somebody who's gone through betrayal or any type of PTSD situation, they said the first most important thing is to validate what they're feeling, because it is odd. I mean, I admit that for myself, to be in a situation that nobody else in the room would understand except for you who are going through it. And so I've had to explain that to my kids and to, you know, that it's really important that I can see why you would feel this way. This makes sense after what you've been through. I mean, my daughter's own wedding at the temple, I practically ruined her wedding, and I went in there totally unexpected. I didn't mean to do that, and luckily it was kept the lid on, and it was also understood that I should have just experienced that and gone through that before I went to that wedding. But again, in the book, it talks about the importance of validating that and helping them, you know, just ride through that experience, because it's so real. You talk about the cringe factor. The feelings that you get when you go through PTSD are so real and fit so well, but it's confusing. So, anyway.
I think some people don't deserve our trust anymore. So I think that's part of it. It's if we put our trust out there, but we really hadn't developed it in ourselves yet, it needs to come back here before it can go back out there. And then we judiciously have the right to choose whom we want to trust again. Y'all remember the Hoffman bombings, and you know, it was President Hinckley who was pretty much at that time the spokesperson. And I remember, and we haven't ever been able to find this, but I remember reading an interview with him in which someone had said, you know, you got duped. You got taken here, kind of a thing. What about that? What about the future? What about, you know, not knowing this? And he said, we can live our lives not trusting anybody or anything and think we're going to be okay and never get hurt. He said, what kind of life is that? The reality is, if you want to live a full life, you need to trust again, and knowing that you could get taken again, and then you deal with it. So I've always thought that was a very wise comment from him.
For me, it's important to remember that I used to think that trust was a gift and that you gave it to everyone, but it's not a gift. It's something that needs to be earned. And it's like this lady was saying right here, how you gain the trust back in someone is the consistent behavior. It is putting that person in a position and allowing them to show you that they can be trusted. And it has to happen over and over and over again. And I also suffer from PTSD, and it is very real, and it can come at any time, and you need to be around people that validate that and that can support you with that. But as far as trust goes, it's very difficult, and it's not something that you just give as a gift for everyone that you come in contact with. It needs to be earned, and it needs to be earned a little bit at a time.
I'll just depart just momentarily from the subject what we're talking about, and about PTSD. I had an experience about, it was July 1st, so it's been about a month and a half ago. I had recently bought a new motorcycle, and I'd owned it for about 2 weeks, and I'd gone up to Squaw Peak on a little ride, and I'm coming back, and I'm going down the road. As I'm coming down the road, I look down the road, and there is a deer, and I'm going to change lanes to turn left, and on University Avenue in Provo, going to go up Center Street in Orem, and there's a deer standing out in the road, and I'm thinking, that's not really a deer there and everything, and that, to make a longer story shorter, it lunged at me, hit me in the head, knocked me off my motorcycle, and I spun off the ground into the dirt. I was going 45 to 50 miles an hour. That was very traumatic. It was, but this idea that of that post-traumatic syndrome disorder, the deer's head came right at me, and its eye was bigger and bigger, and it hit, its head hit right on my helmet, knocked me right off the ground. Well, for weeks and weeks after that, from time to time, I'd have this flashback of this deer head coming right at me and hitting it. It hit hard, harder than any football game I've ever been in, basketball, any kind of thing. It just smacked me hard. And I mean, I think emotionally, sometimes those same things, we have flashbacks that hit and they come back and trigger. There are places in town where I'll drive and it'll remind me of certain events that happened in an emotional experience or in a relationship that I was at. And suddenly I am back to that same moment again, emotionally. I get right back there, and it's very, very difficult. It's very, very hard to deal with. Music, for me, triggers those emotions as well. I'll be in a certain situation, and a song, or whether it's sometimes a song on the radio or a hymn or whatever, it puts me emotionally right back in that same spot. To get back to the topic at hand, I just want to, you know, bring another real life situation where that traumatic happens, and it's gone away. I don't see the deer nearly as often, and you know, deer, you those I think is very nice, pleasant animals, but I've had a very traumatic experience with deer. My therapist told me at one point in time, and I'm going to just take this opportunity to have free therapy here. My therapist told me, when it comes to trust and rebuilding trust and trusting people, that trust but verify. You trust the person, and you have to turn around and take that leap of faith. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. No risk, no reward. At some point in time, you're going to have to take some risks. You can't, and it's a balancing act. I know that some of you have said things different than that, but my philosophy is no risk, no reward. Trust but verify. However, I have not had a lot of success with trust but verify, because as a person who has trust issues, when I see a situation that things are not adding up and I bring it up to the person, boy, the relationship takes a downward spiral real fast. And it comes from Ronald Reagan and whatever, trust but verify, with the Russians and the bombs and stuff. Does any of you have had experience where trust but verify helps build a relationship? And have you had experience where trust but verify, because you're not trusting even though the person is being totally trustworthy, and you're having huge doubts about them, and it just made the relationship go bad?
I'm a little confused. Are you saying...
Go ahead. Confuse the rest of us on the
table. Are you saying that you weren't trusting of the person, or you
were,
and then you're verifying?
I was trusting, and then when I saw something didn't look right, when I verified it and then brought it up, oftentimes my facts would be wrong, and I would look really, really bad.
Well, did you
when I verified
fix
it.
That then, if you got the right facts?
It was hard to fix it. They, uh-huh. Then the trust went the other direction. They didn't trust me because mm-hmm. I didn't trust mm-hmm. them.
Because my first response was, you know, if you tried to verify and that didn't work, good, because isn't that what you wanted? Not to be in a relationship with someone where you couldn't verify or talk or trust. On the other hand, that's that piece I think President Huber might be referring to. If you are suspicious, if you won't trust, if we won't take that risk or go to that place, of course that's going to be communicated. And we carry that with us. So the work is ours to do, I believe, so that you can bring that and then, you know, have a good relationship with someone. If they prove not trustworthy, absolutely, don't go there. Don't trust them. Take it and find someone who can be. But if you can't trust them because no matter what they do, you're reading into it, like Betty Ann was her example, then you just have more work to do yet. I don't know, maybe that's too simplistic, but...
Is there, in our, I know that some have made some comments. We have about a time for two or three more questions. Is there people that in the audience that have any particular questions that they have that we haven't covered? Go ahead. Come on up.
So once you got past the things in your life that you want to go on with your life, you don't want to think about it anymore, you get into some other relationships, do you expose yourself so that that person sees you, what you've gone through, and maybe they, you know, maybe they think, well, how stupid could you be? Or what's wrong with you? Are you, you must have been open for this. I was raped here in Salt Lake City about 30 years ago when they didn't have counselors, and went up to the University of Utah. The good part about it was I had, they found a ovarian cyst size of a grapefruit, so they took that out, and then I went down to the police and I confronted them and looked for pictures and pictures and pictures and couldn't find anything, and those cops were just sitting there laughing, and I was like 22, I was divorced, and and there's other things that have happened in my life, and sometimes I wonder if they, you know, they sort of, those things gravitate to you if you accept it, sort of subconsciously. Other things have happened as well. But then I don't want to think about it. I want to think about the new person, me as a new person, going on with my life. And I don't really want to think about that anymore. But then there's this, you know, several years of things happening, and if a person wants to get to know you, what do you say? You know, I've been divorced 26 years,
And what do you say? I mean, you know, it's like you can't erase the past, and you still want to go on with your life, and you don't want to think about this, so why don't you bring it up? And that person has to find out. You have to dig it all up again, talk about this stuff that you don't want to live with anymore. You just want to just bury it and go on with life. Because what good would it be just to keep on with,
What I'm going to say is going to sound easy compared with the process to do it. I understand that. But you know how we say forgive and forget? I have a really good memory. I don't forget things. But it doesn't mean I can't forgive, because my life experiences have brought me to the place I am now. So the person you are now is a combination and a culmination of all those things, of the good, the ill, of what has happened to you negatively. And to repudiate any one of those things is almost like to repudiate yourself. So what I would recommend or say try to move toward is integrating those experiences in such a way so that they don't have the power to put you in despair like they did back then. They were treated badly by the police, no doubt about it. But that it allows you to move forward and know that you don't have to turn your back on who you were, because what you are right now, what you like right now, is part of all of that. And I think, you know, they're kind of, I'm also single like Perry, and, you know, I've heard these rules, you know, well, you don't tell him this on a first date, and you don't tell him that until a third date, and you don't tell him this until you know me here, whatever that is. Someone who you want at that core level is going to be able to see all of that for you. But would you tell him maybe on the first date? Maybe not. But do you understand? It's really about, I think our challenge as human beings is to integrate this life experience we have. And we're all going to do it in our own unique way. And that's the good news. That's not necessarily the bad news. So you may not want to think of X, Y, and Z right now. Maybe that's something to take to therapy. My view of what therapy can do is takes a huge wound. You know, when you've ridden a bicycle and you fell and you get that horrible knee thing. Everybody did riding a bike, right? Anybody get away with that? I don't know them. And, you know, at first it's bleeding like crazy. The first thing you do is stop the bleeding. That's all. You're not worried about the scar yet. You just want to stop the bleeding. And then it starts to coat over, right? And if it's a knee, it might reopen because it's a joint that you're using. But eventually, the scar is there. And when you see the scar, you remember that you fell down. But it doesn't have the power to hurt you like it did when it was bleeding profusely. And that's kind of what I'm saying. Love to see you get to that point where you can remember those things that happened to you, and they don't have the power to make you feel horrid or take that to, you know, into a relationship with you.
So, in other words, you know, they said to have an intimate relationship with someone, you should be who you really are.
I don't know.
You can interpret that in a way where a mother wouldn't tell their child every single thing that they
would. Yeah, yeah, I honestly, I think that. Oh dear. Help me. would you have to tell someone everything that's happened to you? That would be, I think, between you and yourself as far as, you know, what's really important. You can't share everything with everybody, and maybe that's not appropriate. You have to... Here's how you would know. If you felt not telling them was interfering with you being able to really be intimate, then that might be something to think about sharing with them. Because if your goal is to be intimate and have a full relationship, you know, then that's how you would measure things. That makes sense? And you know, even though sometimes with trauma, we get treatment right away, as we change and grow and mature, things can come back up that we might need a little refresher course for. That's all. Because now there's somebody maybe important to you in a different way. And so to be able to take that where you want it, you just may need a little bit more because now you're older and wiser and you know more.
I'll make this the last question before we
leave, and I kind of follow up on the same one that area we were talking about. And it's also a more of a hardball question too. If a person has something like a double life where they have another wife in another city, or they've done something, they've been horrendously abusive, according to Mormon theology, you can repent and your sins are as white as snow and it's a blanket white sheet. Take an example and say someone has done something really life-altering, horrible, they repent of it. In their next relationship, are they free to turn around and act like that never happened and go on with the rest of their life? It's kind of similar to what you're saying in some ways, but yours was more like, when do you talk to them or should you talk to them? But is it fair to give them carte blanche to go forward as if nothing had ever happened? Theologically, the answer is yes, but therapeutically, is this a good idea?
Anyone there?
In my situation, my ex remarried a wonderful woman that my kids all love. I had read a book that said, in a divorce situation, that a lot changes between a husband and a wife, but very little should change between the parent and child. So I had said to my kids, you know, whatever you need with your dad, the green light is still there. In my situation, this is just what I chose to do. It's kind of the alcoholics theme of let go and let God. I don't like chasing around covered wagons. That's what I call them, the covered wagon wild ride, and I'll cut as many ropes as I can against a wild ride that I'm being dragged behind. In my situation, I would not call her, or talk to her. That to me is between him and her, he and she, or whatever him and her. But that would be mine. It's just I have found in my own situation that the more I keep saying this, that if the marriage was going to work, it would have worked. And since it's not working, it's just a sour place to go. So I just don't visit that place very often. I visit it, I have a respectful relationship with my ex because we'd like to have that to maintain. I'm not going out to lunch with him. but I do respect his relationship. I just respect his life. And that includes all of his drama. I that may sound, nobody may like to hear that statement, but I just grew up in a home where, whatever goes up, unless I hear something, if I hear of anything that goes on that's abusive, the rules all change. But, under the circumstances, we had our relationship. He hurt me. I don't know if he's hurting her. It's up for her to find out. I don't think if I called her, she'd listen anyway, because love is what love is kind of thing. So anyway, I just, in my situation, let go, let God. If he gets a temple recommend next year, hey, that's between him and God, him and her. The reason I divorced is he's not in my life, so I'm not going to keep joining his life.
Have you thrown away your love letters?
Yes, oh yeah. Marriage, wedding dress, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks all. This was a session with the panelists. Give them a hand.
Thank you.
This is session 234, Shattered, 6 Steps from Betrayal to Recovery. Thanks.